You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Mental health care can be difficult for many patients. It can be hard to properly diagnose the issues a person is dealing with, and in some cases even harder to find a proper treatment. The field of psychiatry has a long history of these struggles to identify and treat mental illness over the last 200 years, with mixed results at times and some shocking and traumatic treatments along the way. In a new book, our next guest documents that troubled history and how it shapes the way we treat mental illness today. He says there's no single solution for many people facing the most difficult kinds of mental illness, but there are changes we could and should make. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience yourself with mental health treatment? Did you find success with the methods you tried? Are you a caregiver, maybe for someone in your family who's dealing with some kind of severe mental illness? What kind of help do they and do you need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew Scull is a distinguished professor of sociology emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. His new book is called Desperate Remedies: Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Andy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
There's a running theme in your book of kind of overconfidence at different periods of history. In the early 1800s, asylums were going to cure 80% of mental illness, then nerve tonics, then Freudian psychotherapy, then biology and pills, then cognitive behavioral therapy. You write in your conclusion, humility and open-mindedness are deeply desirable qualities that are in short supply. That seems like one of the main points in your book. Do we need more humility in the scope of psychiatry?
Yes, I think we do. And I think as well, we need to beware of trumpeted statements that the cure is at hand. Unfortunately, there have been many of those in the past, as you've just illustrated very briefly. And all too often, with experience, we've learned that far from being helpful, they've often turned out to be extremely harmful. It's not that there's been no progress in the field, but we have no psychiatric penicillin. And even today, if you ask, do we understand where depression comes from, why people experience bipolar disorder, how is it that people become schizophrenic? The honest answer to that is we simply don't know. So we're kind of groping in the dark. We have some treatments that help symptomatically. They often come with a serious price to be paid for whatever relief they provide. And they're certainly far from being the kind of interventions that we'd like to see, since the degree of suffering of people with mental illness, and of course, the suffering of those around them trying to cope with the devastation this causes, is quite enormous. And so this is a very fraught area. Mental illness is far more widespread than we often think, until it affects ourselves or one of our loved ones or somebody we're close to. So this is an enormous problem. It's compounded by the stigma that seems to attach to the mentally ill, and also to a degree to the professionals who try to treat them. And it remains a great mystery, I think, despite 200 years and large amounts of money being plowed into research. We're a long way from seeing solutions, which isn't to say there aren't things we could do better than we're presently doing. But being a little skeptical, exhibiting a certain amount of humility in the face of what is an awful set of problems is, I think, absolutely one of the keys to advancing from our present state.
You tell really a 200-year story. I want to start a little more recently. The move, what did it start, 4 or 5 decades ago, to go from large-scale institutionalization of people with more severe mental illness to something else. And often you write very poorly thought out something else. Can you talk about that process and what it's meant for what we see today?
Yes, indeed. It's important to note that for about 100, 125 years, the United States, like most of the developed world embrace the idea that the major solution to this, the problems of serious mental illness, was to lock people up in what were first thought to be therapeutic institutions. And that was founded in an atmosphere of great optimism about what these places could accomplish. By the end of the 19th century, that optimism had almost completely disappeared. And yet numbers institutionalized continued to grow very steadily. About 400,000, the outbreak of World War II, 500,000 people in mental hospitals in a given day in 1950, about 560,000 in the mid 50s. And then slowly at first, and then quite abruptly from the late 1960s onwards, we abandoned that whole approach. And that came about in part by a rising tide of criticism of the mental hospitals as warehouses for unwanted people, as places that were anti-therapeutic by their very nature, that systematically dehumanized both their patients and staff. So there was a real rise in the criticism and a lot of journalistic exposés of the sad state of America's mental hospitals. Right after World War II, journalists who had visited Nazi Germany and seen the death camps, Dachau and Belsen and Buchenwald, came back here and visited America's backwards of its mental hospitals and described them in the words of one of the journalists as America's own death camps. So the reputation of mental hospitals fell drastically, and particularly from the 1960s forward, there was an argument that communities would be receptive to the mentally ill, that we had new treatments, particularly the new drugs that had come on the scene in the early 1950s, and that community care could substitute for institutionalization, and that would be a grand reform. It also not so incidentally promised to save a lot of money. Mental hospitals absorbed huge fractions of state budgets in the early 1950s. In New York State, for example, about 30% of the state current budget was spent on its mental hospitals. That was a huge slice of the money that states were spending. But the reality was that the community wasn't terribly receptive to the return of the mentally ill. The drugs were at best a very partial fix, and for many patients they didn't work at all. And there was no real infrastructure built in the community to cope with the needs of people with serious mental illness. Housing, social supports, some respite care, for example, for families, all of those things were largely missing. And in the excitement over getting rid of the snake pits, as a famous film of the 1940s had it, everybody assumed that anything that replaced the asylums had to be better. And we've learned from bitter experience that that's not the case. I split my time between San Francisco and San Diego, and I occasionally visit LA and New York City, and everywhere I go, the problem of homelessness, and while that's not exclusively a problem of the mentally ill, a large fraction of those on the streets are suffering from serious mental illness. And what we've created is a system where many patients move from the gutter to the flop house to the jail, occasional contact with psychiatry for the prescription of drugs, which they often don't take, and then back out into the street, and the whole cycle repeats and perpetuates itself with horrible consequences for the lives of those people, and also severe consequences for our general well-being and the state of our cities and even our rural communities as these problems fester and multiply.
Talking to Andy Scull, author of the book Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Whitewater. Tom, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. My concern with this topic is just that this has touched my family before, and I currently belong to a number of support communities in Wisconsin where people are experiencing this. And the lack of a whole body look at mental illness is something that's come up more than once. A number of the people that I've talked with who have finally gotten help, when they were dealing with mainstream medicine, no one ever looked to see, did you have a brain injury before? Do you have food allergies? Do you have chemical sensitivities? Is there some other biochemical cause for your mental illness difficulties? They were simply placed on prescription medications to suppress their symptoms with the hope that it would do something, and they didn't achieve recovery that way. It wasn't until there was a more whole-body approach that they actually got stable and got some help.
Tom, thanks for the call. Andy, what do you think?
Well, I would agree. Psychiatry has, in the last four decades or so, become increasingly dependent on pharmaceuticals, on drugs as the sole and singular response to the problem of mental illness. And I think it's much more multifaceted than that. I would respectfully disagree a bit with the caller in the sense that I do think that we simply don't know enough about the origins of mental illness to confidently say, oh, it's diet, oh, it's stress, oh, it's abnormal brain biochemistry. It seems to me this is an enormously fraught and poorly understood area, but I would agree with him that coping with the problem has to go beyond simply prescribing antipsychotics or antidepressants, has to take account of the social circumstances of the person and of the family, very often who is trying to cope with an enormously stressful situation. So in that sense, the pressure to adopt a broader approach to the problems of mental illness is one I would heartily endorse.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Andy Scull. His new book is Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. You can join in with your questions for our guest, maybe share your own experiences as someone dealing with mental illness and trying to find treatment, a family member, or a treatment provider. What support do you need? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Andy Scull, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of California, San Diego, talking about his new book, Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Madison. Nancy, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to thank the professor for being on today, and I just want to say I'm a one of the founding members of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the founding president of NAMI Wisconsin, and a founder of NAMI Dane County. One of the things that it is important, I think, to be discussed is the implementation of assertive community programs. And PACT, the Program of Assertive Community Treatment, out of Mendota, here in Madison, Wisconsin, is celebrating its 50th year. My son is a client of that program. That is, in a sense, a wraparound program, which has shown, it's demonstrated through the decades, what it can do to help individuals with serious and persistent mental illness in the community. And I would say the track record has been excellent. My son is now 66 and a half. He worked for 20 years part-time at the Mental Health Center. He gave over 750 educational talks about mental illness. He has been, quote-unquote, compliant with medications through 48 years and 45 years as a client of PACT. So we do know how to treat persons quite effectively within the community, and it has been demonstrated and continues to be demonstrated. here in Wisconsin, and there are assertive community treatment programs around the country.
Nancy, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. And Andy, you write, you know, sometimes we focus on, will this pill cure or this version of talk therapy cure someone? You also, I think, want to see more focus on community and helping people, even if they're not, quote unquote, cured, live good lives in a community.
Absolutely. Nancy, thank you for that call. And indeed, you know, we certainly need more in the way of community support programs of the sort you describe. Wisconsin actually modeled quite early on in the deinstitutionalization process some of these programs. And as model programs, they were quite successful, at least if one can rely on the published data. The problem is that these sorts of supports are in incredibly short supply across the country. So people who are fortunate enough to get those kinds of services may do rather well, but as a general principle, this is not what people with severe mental illness experience or their families come to that. So yes, more social supports, more help with sheltered housing, more help with the sense of social isolation that often accompanies mental illness. All of these things would be a distinct step forward from the situation we face now.
Nancy, thanks for that call. We'll go to Virginia now in Milwaukee. Virginia, hi.
Hi to both of you. Gia, I'm so really grateful that I just came into my apartment and heard you on the radio, and I thought, I definitely have to get in on this conversation. My daughter is, she just did turn 63, and she looks like she's about 55 or something. I guess we just have that youthful look in her family. I don't know. But she was headstrong to be a model. And I have her beautiful professional modeling picture in her room. She's in a group home, and this is the thing that has saved her. She was like so many other people who have this, I call it a monster on your back. And you can't get it off, but you can tame it. And how they tamed it with her, fortunately, the medical community, with trial and error through the years, have found that medication does work. And of course, it's also the talk therapy, I think, too. So she had a fall, and it was a life-threatening fall. So you might say she was dead and hit her head on the cement. And she was living at large, you know, like some of the people were turned out from the behavioral health here in Milwaukee. And for whatever reason, thought that they could live on their own. And, of course, my daughter could not. She always got herself into some kind of problems or whatever with other people or whatever.
I understand, Virginia. We don't have too much time left. But Virginia says the solution, Andy, wasn't medicine or talk therapy or a group home. It was a combination of a lot of different things. And it sounds like a long time of trial and error.
Well, I think trial and error is an accurate assessment of what we often confront, professionals confront in trying to deal with mental illness. There are a wide range of medications out there. All of them have both some advantages and a great deal of drawbacks. Which one is going to suit a particular patient is hard to know in advance. And the same thing is true of forms of talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and the alternatives to it. So, you know, in the face of a great deal of lack of knowledge about how to proceed, one does the best one can. And indeed, I think that's an accurate assessment of how things go. For many patients, unfortunately, none of these interventions work very well. If you're fortunate, and I hope this caller's daughter is fortunate in that respect, things are better than they otherwise might be. But we all would love the day where we had a cure for these awful conditions. Unfortunately, we're not there yet.
Virginia, thanks for that call. Andy, we have just a minute or so left. There isn't a magic cure for many forms of mental illness. There's not a magic cure for the system. But if there were one change you could communicate to people who, you know, provide the funding, what would it be? What is the most important element that we could change right now?
I think for the last 40 years, particularly the last two decades, there's been a singular emphasis on the biological dimensions of mental illness that unfortunately has had very little in the way of actual therapeutic payoff. So what I'd like to see is a more broad focus on how we proceed from here that takes account of the environmental, of the social, and of the psychological, as well as continuing to do basic research, because for certain forms of serious mental illness, I would be astonished if they didn't turn out to be a biological component, but we don't know what that component is right now. And putting all our eggs in one basket is a bad recipe, I think.
Andy, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on.
That's Andrew Scull, Distinguished Professor of Sociology Emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. He joined us today to share his research, his latest book. It's called Desperate Remedies, Psychiatry's Turbulent Quest to Cure Mental Illness, looking at over 200 years of mental health treatment in the United States, the promises, and where it's gone wrong. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, while the world is focused on Ukraine, there are concerns about China's actions and threats against Taiwan, with a big role in the situation for the United States. We'll find out what's going on in the news this week and what it all means for U.S. foreign policy and for our economy. And Mount Horeb is Wisconsin's home for trolls and not the internet kind. But why is that? We'll get the answer with a new Why Wisconsin answer to a listener question about Norwegian culture here in Wisconsin. You'll want to hear that for sure. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we want to hear about your favorite movie to re-watch. Tell us about a movie you can watch time and time again. You can start now with an email, ideas@wpr.org. First, Wisconsin election officials are in a dispute with Republican lawmakers over a practice known as ballot curing. The process makes it possible to correct mistakes on absentee ballot envelopes, things like missing address information on witness signatures. GOP lawmakers say under state law, only the voter is allowed to fix those errors. But the Wisconsin Election Commission has given guidance as far back as 2016, allowing local election clerks to fix some of these mistakes. We're taking a closer look at how ballot curing works in Wisconsin and how changes could affect upcoming elections where absentee voting is already underway. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Should local clerks be able to correct some mistakes on mail-in ballots or fill in missing info, a zip code if they know it, for example, for an address that wasn't quite complete? Or is that something that only the voter should be able to do? Have you encountered these problems yourself as a voter or working on an election staff? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Rob Yablon is an associate professor of law at UW-Madison and co-director of the State Democracy Research Initiative. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
I gave the basics of ballot curing. I think there, Rob, could you flesh it out for us a little bit? What do we mean by that?
Yeah, that was a good introduction. I mean, when we're talking about ballot curing, we're talking about correcting errors or omissions on absentee ballots to make sure that they're legally compliant and can be counted. So, you know, voters who have voted absentee before will know that there's a certification form on the outside of the absentee ballot envelope that they complete and return with their ballot. They have to sign and date it, and they have to have a witness sign and date it, and the witness also has to put on their address. And if that form is not adequately completed, their ballot isn't valid. Now, there are some omissions that only a voter or the witness can correct. And so if the voter fails to sign it, if a witness fails to sign it, that's not something that a clerk can fix. If the clerk notices in advance, the clerk can hopefully send that ballot back to the voter and let the voter correct it. If the voter's in the area, the clerk might be able to call them and tell them that they're going to have to come in and add that signature. The controversy that we're seeing right now is what happens if there is an incomplete witness address on that certification form. 6 years ago, back in 2016, the Elections Commission issued guidance to clerks saying that they should make reasonable efforts to obtain missing address information. And if they're able to find it, they are allowed to fill in that missing information themselves. And that would make the ballot valid. And, you know, so that was guidance that in 2016 was issued by the commission unanimously on a bipartisan basis, but it's become much more controversial today.
Yeah, let's spell this out a little more. Say we've got a voter, Rob Roberts, and they fill in their name, Rob Roberts, their street address, but not the city and zip code. And they sign it, of course. So with this definition of ballot curing, under those 2016 rules from the Wisconsin Elections Commission, the person at the clerk's office could look up that street address, say, oh yeah, that's a city in our town, Townville, and then we only have one zip code here. I can write that in. That is, on a very practical level, how this could function.
Exactly. You know, so one thing that someone might do is they just write in their street address, but they don't write in the name of the municipality, and the clerk might know, oh yeah, that is indeed a street in our town. They might even check to see, and in fact, I see that the witness is a registered voter at that address, and with a reasonable amount of confidence, they can say, okay, we know that it is in our town, and they write in the town name. You know, they're not trying to hide this. The instruction is that they're supposed to initial next to it, so there's a record. The clerks, when they make these corrections, you know, often will do so in red ink. But the idea is that voters shouldn't have their ballots not counted just because of that really minor technical omission, and that it would actually, it's just not necessary to trouble the voter, you know, having to send the ballot back with the mail. You know, would you even have time to do that? And so the clerks have been fixing these very minor types of errors.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us in Lafarge. Jack, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I agree with the professor on this because, again, we're looking for valid voters, okay? If the person is a valid voter, and it seems like you're saying that there's errors of omission and the clerk can fix that, it's not like, oh, we're making up of a voter or, you know, there's an illegal voter, whether it is that, you know, we want all the people who are, you know, able to vote, who are legal, to vote. And if there's just this minor error, why does that make that person illegal or their vote not count?
Jack, thanks for the call. And Rob, that takes us to Republicans in the state legislature saying this is a problem. What is the argument we're seeing from Republicans in the state legislature? A committee has said, actually, no, Wisconsin Elections Commission, you should not give this guidance.
Right. You know, so this became a sore point after the 2020 election. As I said, this guidance dates back to 2016. It was operative during the 2016 presidential election, elections in 2018, 2020, a lot of elections in between. But in that 2020 election, as part of broader concerns that were raised by President Trump and his allies about fairness in the electoral process, there was, you know, concern that these kinds of errors in the absentee balloting process may be indicators of some irregularity. And so there's just been a desire to tighten the rules, even when we're dealing with some of these minor technicalities.
We are talking to Rob Yablon, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, co-director of the State Democracy Research Initiative, talking about this idea of ballot curing. The Wisconsin Elections Commission, as you heard, since 2016, has said, hey, election clerks around the state, you can cure these errors in like witness signatures if they leave off the zip code, for example. Republicans in the state legislature saying, no, that goes beyond state law. You shouldn't give this guidance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. So, Rob, where are we now? We've got an election. People can start sending in absentee ballots. The Republican state lawmakers who are looking at this say, you can't do this. The Wisconsin Elections Commission, if I understand correctly, says, yeah, we can. What should voters know?
Yeah, you know, this is a little bit of a confusing situation, definitely not ideal. So, you know, what happened is the legislature asked the Elections Commission to issue a more formal rule, administrative rule, that basically repeated their guidance. The Elections Commission did that earlier this year. And then just last week, a committee of the legislature invalidated that proposed rule. But what the Elections Commission is saying is that the invalidation of that rule doesn't affect the underlying guidance, which has been in effect for 6 years now. And so they say that is still the operative guidance. And I expect that a lot of clerks are going to continue to follow this guidance, although they're probably talking to their lawyers at the municipal level, trying to figure out exactly what they should do. Because as you say, you know, absentee voting is already happening for the August primary.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jack is with us in Caledonia. Jack, hi.
How you guys doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Jack?
Well, I'm sitting outside. I'm waiting for a van to show up. Collect ballots for early voting, and I'm a election observer. Now, the thing I just want everybody to understand, everybody that's listening, WEAC, Wisconsin Election Commission, okay, is not a governing body. They don't have the legal means to change law, okay? Our legislatures do that, okay? So just because they say, you know, you can jump on your one foot and sign your name this way, and it's legal, and don't worry about putting your address on there. You know, all these changes that they want to do, it doesn't go with what Wisconsin state election laws are. Okay, even if somebody says it's okay to do that, it's not okay to do it. It's a down ballot. Only the voter can come and change something on there. Well, I forgot my zip code. Well, you have to go back and take care of it because that's the law. Change the law, and then it's okay. But right now, we have to follow election laws, and people are finding every way not to, okay?
Jack, you know, thanks. I got you. Thanks a lot for the call. Rob, Jack saying Wisconsin Election Commission can implement the laws that exist. They can't change them. And he says they're changing the law if they allow someone other than the voter to fix that witness address.
Well, that's the question, you know, so he is correct that the job of the Elections Commission is to implement the law. And sometimes the law isn't clear. And when the law is unclear and you have, 1,800 municipal clerks that need to make judgments, it's helpful for the Elections Commission to be able to step in and offer some uniform guidance. Now, what the legislature is arguing is that it is, in fact, clear to them that that clerks don't have this power under existing law. And so they're arguing that the commission's guidance isn't proper. And the commission's response, and I think a lot of the clerks who are trying to implement the elections might say, well, really, the law to us isn't clear, and it's helpful for us to get guidance which is meant to implement existing law rather than change it. But that's really the dispute here. Is that what the Elections Commission is doing? Are they just implementing existing law, which is totally proper, or are they changing the law, which is not proper?
Jack, thanks for that call. We're talking to Rob Yablon, Associate Professor of Law at UW-Madison, Co-Director of the State Democracy Research Initiative, looking at ballot curing, how it works, why Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin want to end one version of ballot curing, saying election offices can't add that missing, for example, witness address information onto the ballot envelope. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you voted absentee by mail early in person in past elections? Do you know what to do if your ballot has an error? Have you ever had a problem with incomplete information? Do you work on the other side of things as an election clerk yourself? What do you know? What do you wish you knew? Are there still gray areas? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about Wisconsin's election rules, focusing on the practice of ballot curing. When there's an error on the election, say witness address information on an absentee ballot isn't complete, does the voter have to be the one to add that, or the witness themselves? Or if they can find it easily, can an elections clerk fill that out? Rob Yablon is with us from UW-Madison's State Democracy Research Initiative. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences as a voter or an election clerk. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Rob, as we mentioned, there's an election going on right now, absentee voting. What is a local election clerk supposed to do? I want to give a listen to Claire Woodall-Vogue, director of the Milwaukee Elections Commission. She told WPR last week they've had to stop processing certain ballots until they talk to the city attorney.
What do we do with the ballots that we have already cured? And then what do we do now that we have a new rule, possibly, or a new procedure this close to the election, and when mailing a ballot back to a voter might risk us receiving it in time to be counted.
What is a clerk to do, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, she is encapsulating very well the dilemma that clerks are facing right now. And you know, as she indicated, you know, they're going to be getting legal advice and they'll have to make some decisions because that Wisconsin Elections Commission guidance has not been removed. I suspect that many clerks will make the judgment that they can continue to do what they've been doing in past years and complete that missing information. But it's not clear that all clerks will do that. I suspect that we will see some controversy during and after the election on this. And it's an unfortunate position to be in. You usually want to get the law clarified in advance of voting, but we are at a time now when voting is happening and we don't know exactly how this is going to turn out.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Well, I believe there's a really common sense solution to this. The corrections on the outside of the envelope are really immaterial. What counts is the integrity of the ballot inside. So, fine, you know, correct errors and compare it to the voting roll and inform the people involved of what their address actually is. But beyond this, it seems to me that the Republicans are questioning everything about our elections except for their own victories. And I think people better look at some of their gerrymandered districts and their own vote packing and fundraising and everything else. You know, they're really destroying a system that has worked for, you know, a good long time here.
Tom, thanks for the call. Tom, I think Rob sees this vote curing thing as one element in wider efforts to raise questions about our elections.
Well, you know, I think that a lot of folks probably view what's happening here as part of a larger effort by those in power to tilt the electoral playing field in their favor. You know, I mean, the one account that you can have of what's going on is that the Republicans in the legislature have made a judgment that there are likely to be more Democrats than Republicans that are voting absentee. And so if they can tighten those rules in a way that makes it harder for those absentee ballots to count, that will be a net gain for Republicans. Now, you know, empirically, we'll see whether that's true or not. Unfortunately, you know, they are probably going to have some of their own supporters who have their votes thrown out based on very minor technicalities. You know, I think what the caller was getting at in part is if you can discern that this was in fact the intent of the voter, if you have no reason to think that there was fraud or some other irregularity going on, you really ought to want that vote to be counted. And unfortunately, you know, some of the wrangling that we see now might mean that more of these votes get thrown out.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Rob Yablon is with us from the law school at UW-Madison, looking at vote curing, a dispute between Republican leaders in the legislature and Wisconsin's Election Commission over guidance that says election clerks can complete some missing address information, especially on those witness signatures on absentee ballots. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. For that person voting absentee, Rob, I guess the easy way to get around all this is make sure all your information is there. Do you see enough public awareness, voter education out there to make sure that people do this so it doesn't become an issue in the first place?
You know, of course, there could always be more. I hope that the word is getting out there. I know that there are a lot of municipal clerks that that do a lot, you know, and really try to educate voters on this. And, you know, I think it is just important to say, be careful. Take the time when you're filling out those certificates and your absentee ballot to make sure that you really are dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's, just following the instructions carefully. You know, there are ways that you can track your absentee ballot if you go to myvote.wi.gov to make sure that it has been processed correctly. And to the extent that people really have concerns about the absentee ballot process and they're able to do so, you know, one thing to note is that starting today, we are now in an early in-person voting period. And so you are able to vote in person, not just on election day, but, you know, depending on where you are at in the state, a number of the days between now and August 9th.
And when you do that, I guess there's a clerk there or the elections office will look at your ballot and you can find out right away if you're missing key information.
Right. You know, they will be right there with you. And in fact, I believe that, you know, in fact, that the clerk then becomes the witness for you.
Hopefully they'll know how to do that properly. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Now, you mentioned with some confusion over this, Rob. I mean, there's a concern that, as we saw with the 2020 presidential election, if those laws rules don't get resolved now, somebody might come back after we know the results and challenge them.
Right. You know, again, it is best to get all of this worked out before votes are cast, because then, you know, you're operating with behind a curtain. You don't know who's going to win the race. You don't know how close it's going to be. But, you know, if we ended up with a very close, some very close races in these primaries, you may have challenges where there are disputes about whether particular absentee votes should be counted or not. You know, for example, the law is not crystal clear about how much of a witness address is required. The position that the Elections Commission has taken is that you need the street address, you need the municipality, but if you didn't write in WI, if you didn't write in the zip code, that's not necessary. Well, it's conceivable that someone could challenge that and say, actually, the failure even to include the zip code ought to invalidate the ballot. And it's just a shame that a lot of this, as I've said, remains unresolved while votes are being cast.
Time for one more caller. Alice is with us in New London. Alice, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Alice?
I don't understand what the problem is with absentee ballots. If you vote in person, there are two people at a desk. You give them your name. They look it up to see if you are a registered voter, and they mark that you came in and voted. If somebody voted a second time or instead of you, that would be known because they couldn't mark it twice. It would be impossible. Why don't they do that with absentee ballots? I don't know why they can't. I mean, it'd be the same thing as if they came in person. It'd take the same amount of time. All they have to do is have those books in front of them.
Alice, thanks for the call. And Rob, I believe the same procedure to double check to make sure that absentee ballot isn't somehow allowing somebody to vote twice. That does happen. The debate here is over this, again, that witness signature on the outside of the ballot and whether or not an incomplete address means that voter doesn't even get their vote counted once.
That's right. So, you know, to be clear, there are safeguards and protocols in place to make sure, for example, that someone isn't receiving or returning multiple absentee ballots, that someone isn't returning an absentee ballot and then also trying to cast a vote in person. I mean, you know, there are logbooks and so on that prevent that from happening. So, yes, the issue here is just what if there is one of these minor technical omissions on the ballot certificate? Should the ballot still count? Should the clerk be able to correct that error, or is that a ballot that should just be tossed aside uncounted?
Alice, thanks for that call. And just our last few moments, Rob, is this going to be as big a deal this year? 2020, a lot of people wanted to vote absentee because of COVID. I think people are less worried now. Do you anticipate this being such a huge part of our election this year?
Well, you know, I suspect that the absentee voting rate won't be quite as high as it was in 2020, but I anticipate that there still will be probably hundreds of thousands of votes that are cast absentee. And whether that becomes an issue in the aftermath of the election may just depend on how close the election ends up being, both the August 9th primary and then the election in November. And hopefully we will have, you know, more of these questions answered by the time we get to November's general election.
Rob, thanks again for joining us.
Good to be with you.
That's Rob Yablon, Associate Professor of Law at UW-Madison, co-director of the State Democracy Research Initiative, with us today to explain what ballot curing is and the debate over its use in Wisconsin elections. Coming up, we're asking you about movies. We want to hear about that movie you can watch anytime, no matter how many times you've already seen it. Get started now. Share your movie to rewatch on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.